Chapter 12. Go Ask Alice. Alice Waters wants to help. Shortly after Barack Obama's election victory, the mother of slow food wrote the new president a letter advising him of his first order of business. That the, quote, purity and wholesomeness of the Obama movement must be accompanied by a parallel effort in food at the most visible and symbolic place in America, the White House. Reminding the president that they'd helped raise money for him, she proposed that she and her friends, then gourmet editor Ruth Reichel and restaurateur Danny Meyer, be brought aboard immediately as a small advisory group, a kitchen cabinet, if you will, to help with your selection of a White House chef, a person with integrity and devotion to the ideals of environmentalism, health, and conservation. That there already was a chef at the White House, a person of integrity and devotion, seems not to have occurred to Ms. Waters. Nor did it seem to matter that this chef had been sourcing and serving largely organic, local, and sustainable food for years, or that there already was a kitchen garden. Making the mistake of judging a kitchen staff solely by its customers, Waters observing, or at least hearing of, the previous tenant no doubt assumed the worst. But I doubt she considered the matter long enough for even a cursory Google search. It was, as it so often is, ultimately, all about Alice. I cannot forget the vision I have had since 1993, she gushed beatifically, of a beautiful vegetable garden on the White House lawn. It would demonstrate to the nation and to the world our priority of stewardship of the land, a true victory garden. She got her garden in the end, as things turned out, though the new president managed to resist the temptation to appoint Ms. Waters to government office. As ham-fisted and clumsy as this approach was, a crude and obvious blend of self-aggrandizement and genuine good intentions, it would probably have gone down a lot better had Waters bothered to vote in the previous 44 years. Whatever your politics, you have to admit that the differences, both philosophical and practical, between Bush and Gore and Bush and Kerry were striking, to say the least. Those were close contests. Whichever way you went, your vote inarguably counted for something. One need only read the front page of the newspaper to see how that decision played out and will continue to play out for some years. So there's simply no way Alice or anybody else can realistically make the argument that there's no difference, man, it's all the same military-industrial complex. I am admittedly bitter about this. It sticks in my craw. It's something about Waters that I just can't get past. After she'd boasted of not voting since 1966, it seemed a little crass of Waters to presume to now tell the president what to do, particularly as he'd arrived in the White House facing a newly collapsed worldwide financial system, spiraling unemployment, and two wars, both of which were going badly. Americans were being thrown out of work in unheard-of numbers, and here was Alice, leaping on board to promote, among other things, the idea that we should be spending more on food. But then tone and timing have never been a strong point with Waters. Let it be said that on balance, I would like the world to look someday much like Alice probably wants it to look. A city on a hill, or many cities on hills, surrounded by unbroken vistas of beautiful countryside. Small, thriving, family-run farms growing organic, seasonal, and sustainable fruits and vegetables specific to the region. Healthy, happy, antibiotic-free animals would graze freely over the land, depositing their perfectly odorless, organic shit back into the food chain, so other wonderful things might grow. The schoolchildren of the inner cities would sit down each day to healthy, balanced, and entirely organic meals cooked by happy, self-actualized, and enlightened workers to crispy perfection. Evil lawyers and stockbrokers and vice presidents of development for Bruckheimer Productions would leave their professions and return in great numbers to work the fields of this new agrarian wonderland, becoming better people in the process. In this new age of enlightenment, the dark forces of fast food would wither and die as the working poor abandoned them to rush home between jobs and cook wild nettle risotto for their kids. It would all be clean and safe, and nobody would get hurt. It would all look kind of like Berkeley. Or Italy. Not the real Italy, mind you, but the Italy of wine labels. The Italy of romantic weekend comedies, where lonely, wistful divorcees end up getting joyously boned by lusty young handymen who wear bandanas around their necks and speak with charming accents. the Italy of I Love Lucy, where Italian peasants pick and stomp grapes themselves. Spend any time in the real Italy, however, and you quickly realize that Italians don't really pick grapes much anymore, and they certainly don't stomp them either. They don't pick tomatoes or olives, and they don't shear their sheep. Their tomatoes and olives are picked largely by underpaid Africans and Eastern Europeans, seasonal hires brought in for that purpose, who are then demonized and complained about for the rest of the year, except when blowing motorists in the off-season, as can be readily observed on the outskirts of even the smallest Italian communities these days. The vaunted soil of Italy is as advertised, depending on who you are and where you live. If you live near Naples, though, the chances are good that your farmland is a not-so-secret dumping ground for toxic industrial waste from the north. Here, the true stewards of the earth are neither chefs, nor grandmothers, nor slow food devotees. They're the Naples-based fraternal organization, the Camorra. And the old man growing olives in his backyard in Chianti probably doesn't make a living selling olive oil. He gets by renting his house to Germans. So, who will work the Elysian fields of Alice's imaginary future? Certainly not her neighbors, whose average household income is currently about $85,000 a year. Unless perhaps at the point of a gun. And with Waters' fondness for buzzwords like purity and wholesomeness, there's a whiff of the jackboot, isn't there? A certainty, a potentially dangerous lack of self-doubt, the kind of talk that so often in history leads to actions undertaken for the common good. While it was excessive and bombastic of me to compare Alice to Pol Pot and Amumu, it is useful to remember that he was once a practicing Buddhist and later attended the Sorbonne, and that even in his twisted and genocidal back-to-earth movement, he might once have meant well, too. Who will work these fields? No, really. Somebody's going to have to answer that question soon. If, somehow, we manage to bring monstrously evil agribusinesses like Monsanto to their knees, free up vast tracts of arable land for small, seasonal, sustainable farming, where's all the new help coming from? Seems to me we're facing one of two scenarios. Either enormous numbers of people who've never farmed before are suddenly convinced that waking up at 5 a.m. and feeding chickens and then working the soil all day is a desirable thing, or, in the far more likely case, we'll revert to the traditional method, importing huge numbers of desperately poor brown people from elsewhere to grow those tasty, crunchy vegetables for more comfortable white masters. So while animals of the future might be cruelty-free, which would allow those who could afford to eat them to do so with a clean conscience, what about life for those who will have to shovel the shit from their stalls? Okay, let's say the entire American economy upends itself in fabulous and unpredictable ways, that America suddenly craves fresh vegetables with the ferocity it now has for chicken parts or anything else fried in batter, that the boards of directors and top management at Monsanto and Cargill and ConAgra and Tyson and Smithfield are all indicted, convicted, and packed off to jail. Something I'd very much like to see, by the way, for, I don't know, criminal mediocrity. That farming suddenly becomes the profession of choice for a whole new generation of idealistic Americans. Groovy. I know I'm for it. I am a proud hypocrite. I feed my 2.5-year-old daughter exclusively organic food. My wife is Italian. Around my house, we're more than willing to wait until next year for fresh tomatoes. We enjoy the changing of the seasons and the bounty of the surrounding Hudson Valley. And, of course, the bounty of Spain and Italy as well, readily available at Agata and Valentina, the fantastic but nosebleed expensive Italian market in our neighborhood, New York's Upper East Side. This celebrity chef thing is a pretty good paying gig. What about the Upper Peninsula of Michigan? Or somewhere on the margins of Detroit? What if I were an out-of-work auto worker, living on public assistance or a part-time job? At least I have time to dig a victory garden, right? What does Alice suggest I do if I don't live in the Bay Area, my fields turgid with the diverted waters of the Colorado River? Not a problem. You have to think of a different kind of menu, says Alice. You eat dried fruit and nuts. You make pasta sauces out of canned tomatoes. You're eating different kinds of grains, farro, with root vegetables. All the root vegetables are there. And now, because of the heirloom varieties, you can have a beautiful winter palate. Turnips of every color and shape. Carrots that are white and red and orange and pink. You have different preparations of long cooking meat. Cabbages. Basically, you could eat like a fucking Russian peasant is what she's saying. I don't know if that's what they want to hear in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan or Buffalo. And what about the healthy, pure, wholesome, and organic foods that Alice says I should be buying, particularly if I have children? If I'm making an even average wage as, say, a sole-providing police officer or middle manager. Regular milk is about $4 a gallon. Organic is about twice that. Supermarket grapes are about $4 a bunch. Organic are $6. More to the point, what if I'm one of the vast numbers of working poor getting by in the service sector? What should I do? How can I afford that? Ask this very question directly, Alice advises blithely that one should, quote, make a sacrifice on the cell phone or a third pair of Nike shoes. It's an unfortunate choice of words, and a telling one, I think. You know, those poor people, always with their Nikes and their cell phones. If only they'd listen to Alice, she'd lead them to the promised land for sure. What else should we be doing? Alice says we should immediately spend $27 billion to ensure every school child in America gets a healthy, organic lunch. More recently, she added to this number with the suggestion that fresh flowers on every lunchroom table might also be a worthwhile idea. This is, after all, quote, more important than crime in the streets. This is not like homeland security. This actually is the ultimate homeland security. This is more important than anything else, unquote. Which is where Alice really loses me. Because, well, for me, as a New Yorker, however quaint the concept, homeland security is still about keeping suicidal mass murderers from flying planes into our fucking buildings. And organic school lunches might be more important to you than crime in the streets in Berkeley, but in the underfunded school systems of West Baltimore, I suspect, they feel differently. A healthy lunch is all fine and good, but no use at all to little Timmy if he gets shot to death on the way to school. In fact, $27 billion for organic food for Timmy seems a back-assward priority right now, as so far we failed miserably to even teach him to read. What kind of dreams can a well-fed boy have if he doesn't even have the tools to articulate them? How can he build a world for himself if he doesn't know how to ask for, much less how to get, the things he wants and needs? I, for one, would be very satisfied if Timmy gets a relatively balanced slab of fresh but non-organic meatloaf with a side of competently frozen broccoli, along with reading skills and a chance at a future. Once literate, well-read, and equipped with the tools to actually make his way in this world, he'll be far better prepared to afford Chez Panisse. As of this recording, not too far from Berkeley, just across the bridge in San Francisco's Mission District, they line up every Tuesday for the $1.99 special at Popeye's Fried Chicken. They don't stand in the street waiting for 45 minutes to an hour because it's particularly healthy chicken, or organic chicken, or conscientiously raised chicken, or even good chicken. They do it because it's three fucking pieces for $1.99. Unless we respect that reality, Alice, we're lost. I remember well when I was 11 and 12 years old, demonstrating against the war in Vietnam. My dad and I would travel to Washington. Later, my friends and I would march in New York. And what left a powerful impression in my mind, a lesson worth remembering, was how deeply and instinctively the construction workers, the cops, and firemen, the very people whose families were most likely to be affected by the war, how they hated us. The message was lost, coming as it did from what they saw rightly as a bunch of overprivileged college kids whose mommies and daddies were footing the bill for educations these folks were unlikely to ever be able to afford for their own kids. Here were these loud, self-absorbed ideologues who looked unlike anyone from their world, and who lived nothing like them, but who had no problem talking down to them at every opportunity about the problems of the working classes, usually from the steps of Columbia University. The actual working classes we were shouting at knew what work was, every time they rolled in a bed at night and woke up the next day. Who were these seemingly unemployed, hairy, pot-smoking freaks with their compliant girlfriends and their big talk about the means of production? What production? These cocksuckers didn't produce anything. Thus, a perfectly good message got lost with the messenger. In the same way, having Alice Waters on your side of the argument is like having Alec Baldwin or Barbara Streisand endorse your candidate, a feeling I know all too well. You may agree with everything they say, but you wish they'd just shut the fuck up. No independent voter, disenchanted with the Republicans but struggling to pay his bills, wants to hear about what he should be doing or whom he should be voting for from some spectacularly wealthy artiste who lives in a compound in Hollywood far from the pain and daily toil of ordinary Americans. There is no better example of a counterproductive exercise in advocacy than Alice's recent appearance on 60 Minutes. Introduced by a shockingly lazy and credulous Leslie Stahl as the mother of slow food, a provably false assertion that 30 seconds of Googling would have put to rest, St. Alice of Berkeley was depicted floating ethereally above the fray as she grazed through an expensive green market, pontificating dreamily about the joys of local produce and sustainable, socially conscientious eating. Then she chose to cook Leslie a single egg over a roaring wood fire in her Berkeley home. I don't know about you, but burning up a couple of cords of firewood for a single fucking egg doesn't exactly send a message of sustainability to me. I believe the restrictions on wood fires are, in fact, particularly restrictive in Berkeley. I know I can't have one in Manhattan without a spectacularly expensive combination of bafflers, catalytic converters, filters, and exhaust system, as well as the permits and legal work that one would need before installing them. They're sensitive about such things in Berkeley, what with half the world's carbon emissions said to come from wood fires and all. If Alice is cooking eggs like that every morning with her oatmeal and fresh-squeezed orange juice, her neighbors are enjoying the second-hand equivalent of a pack of Pall Malls. Later in the program, when the action moved over to Chez Panisse, Alice, continuing to fetishize local produce, proudly commented on a delivery of brightly colored vegetables from Chino Farms. Here, her argument was undercut somewhat by the fact that Chino Farms, last time I looked anyway, is in San Diego. That's a nearly 12-hour drive by truck to Chez Panisse, or an hour or so on a jet plane. Exactly how local or sustainable is that? But then, this is kind of par for the course. What's okay for Alice is, well, different than what's okay for you. That was certainly the unmissable, by anyone but Stahl, message of the 60-minute segment. Examine the case of the series of dinners Alice threw in Washington, D.C. to celebrate the Obama inauguration. Promoted in the press as an exemplary series of small affairs celebrating her sustainable locavorian values, the thing mushroomed into a $500-a-plate clusterfuck. In spite of the fact that Washington, D.C. has plenty of excellent chefs and cooks of its own, Alice flew in well-known chefs, their crews, and presumably many of the ingredients they'd need from all over the country. How much hydrocarbon was released into the atmosphere bringing in these outsiders, clearly better than the local yokels, it was implied, will never be known. But one imagines that the cooks could have been sourced locally with little difficulty. It's unfair and nitpicking, but it's irresistible for me not to point out one particular magic moment at a meal Alice threw with Chef Tom Colicchio and cookbook author Joan Nathan. At one point, after taking a bite of food, Nathan started to choke. Waters' reaction was to charge out into the dining room and inquire if anyone knew the Heimlich maneuver. Now, Chez Panisse has been open since 1971, one of the longest-running restaurant successes in America. Alice, it was my understanding, was the executive chef, a title that, if nothing else, implies spending a fair amount of your adult life in proximity to the choking victim sign, ubiquitous and mandated by law in every professional kitchen. There's not an American chef alive who doesn't have that diagram imprinted on his or her brain, except in Alice. Tom Colicchio, who also has seen more than his share of television studios, certainly knew what to do. He stepped right up, placed his fist in the appropriate area, and dislodged the obstruction, thus saving Ms. Nathan's life. Which leads one to the question, is Alice even a chef? Was she ever a chef, in any conventional sense of that word? I, for one, after reading all the accounts, official and unofficial, of Alice's career and the history of Chez Panisse, can't find a single supporting source to verify that she was ever a chef. And yet, year after year, she is described adoringly as such by people who know better. And if she's not a chef, well then, who is she? And why is she allowed to annoy me? Why do I listen to her? Why do I care? There it is again. That faint, mellifluous voice in my head telling me, Alice is right. Alice is right about everything. Granted, this is the same voice that once compelled me to sit repeatedly for hours at a time in crowded halls that reeked of poor quality Mexican weed watching hot tuna. Actually, if the voice sounds like anybody, it's David Crosby singing Almost Cut My Hair, a song about which I'm still in some secret place, uncontrollably sentimental. The voice persists. It tells me, fuck reality, man. Embrace the dream. Let your freak flag fly. Just because the counterculture, the revolution, all those 60s hopes and dreams were corrupted, co-opted, and eventually crushed by the overpowering weight and impermeability of the system, as we should have known they always would be, that doesn't mean it wasn't at least for a while sometimes a beautiful thing, right? Something got better for all that, right? I can't think now what exactly, but I'm sure the world improved in some way, in spite of all the nonsense and self-indulgence, in spite of the way things turned out. LSD sure raised my consciousness a bit. There's no doubt that it made me think about the world from perspectives I might otherwise never have visited. From that first barrel of purple haze, the opening bars of Court of the Crimson King, I'm pretty sure I achieved enlightenment of a sort. That and a few records are what I got out of the 60s. So maybe LSD is a good metaphor for Alice. I may not want any now, but I'm glad she was around. And I may even be slightly better for the experience. I'm constantly having an argument with Alice in my head, an ongoing conversation disagreement, and she always wins, just as in life. When I met her for a panel discussion a while back, I was loaded for bear. I'd reread her biographies, consulted contemporaneous accounts, tracked down every silly thing she's ever said, briefed myself for a showdown. But then, there she was, a nice old lady with literally an armload of produce and an expression that could only be described as serene. She floated across the room, clasped my hand between both of hers, smiled warmly, and I knew then that I could never pull the trigger. Maybe Alice's dream is what's important. Maybe it doesn't matter whether that dream leads anywhere beyond where we already are, or even if it leads eventually to a bad place. That can hardly negate the beauty of the original idea. So maybe the big winner who gets to scoop up the gold at the end of Alice's rainbow turns out to be Whole Foods with their 50-odd checkout counters and their sanctimony at any price. The bad guys always win in the end, right? She can't have seen that coming. If I think about Alice Waters in this fashion, it becomes much less painful. Who cares how great Chez Panisse is now, or whether or not Alice Waters was ever a chef in the conventional sense of that word? Looking back at that golden time in Berkeley, it matters not at all who was responsible for the revolution or in what measure. If the true genius who created what we came to know as California and then New American or seasonal regional, who changed menus and dining as we know it forever, was Alice or Jeremiah Tower or Joe Baum years earlier, does not matter. What we do know is that whatever happened, it happened, undeniably caught on, and finally exploded out of Alice's restaurant. She created a space where something really, really important came together, involving some very talented, very creative people who in any other setting or combination would probably not have flown so far and so high. Hers was a virtual cradle of revolution. As far as map coordinates go, there's little doubt of that. What is also certain is that Alice appreciated the food of France and what it might mean to us in a way that few others did at the time. And she applied that passion in ways that no one in America had previously considered. In those days, when the dream was new and Chez Panisse was just starting up, it was democratic, inclusive, dysfunctional, and ludicrously, admirably unprofitable. Had someone with any business sense at all attempted to do what Alice was trying to do, it never would have happened. Surely, this was a very fine and good thing. Alice thinks what we eat is important. So do I. She thinks it's the most important thing in the world. I do not. But I'm quite sure that we both have made major decisions in our lives, gained and lost friends, based on what's to eat. Alice thinks farmers should make more money, growing stuff that's both good-tasting and good for us. Who could be against that? I like farms, so I don't want to work on one, I doubt very much that Alice does either. So we have that in common, too. She thinks, as I do, that we should be aware of what's good in our own backyards and support those things by eating them and growing more of them. I'm with her, to a point, but then I don't have a backyard. Strikingly, she is, and always has been, a carnivore. There is no question as to her position on foie gras. For decades, in the middle of Berkeley, she has unapologetically championed the use of animal flesh as food rather than as something that should someday win the right to vote. In this respect, being blissfully out of touch with what's going on around her has served her well. In fact, it's Alice's very hypocrisy that belies her true virtues, because what's truly wonderful about Alice is that she is first and foremost essentialist. When you see Alice preaching about how you should be eating local while nibbling on sea urchin roe from Hokkaido or foie gras from Gascony, at least you know she really appreciates the good stuff. It may be strategically foolish and inappropriate and bad for her argument to be seen cooking a fresh-laid organic egg over an open fire for Leslie Stahl, but I'll bet it tasted fucking delicious. What makes Alice Waters such a compelling character is her infectious enthusiasm for pleasure. She's made lust, greed, hunger, self-gratification, and fetishism look good. When Alice shows you a bunch of radishes, you fucking want them. Where have those radishes been all my life? I need them. Who cares if she knows the Heimlich maneuver? Did Gandhi know the Heimlich maneuver? Does Bono? In skimming over the pages of a recent biography, I see there is the oft-cited charge that Alice has made a career of taking credit for the work of others. To which I'd reluctantly have to ask, exactly which chefs, to one extent or another, haven't done that? How could the batty hippie chick have really been responsible for such an important era in gastronomy is the implied question. Yet so many male chefs have climbed or leaped to the top over the smashed bodies of subordinates and peers without accruing fault or foul. The question lingers, and along with it I gather some animus, because Alice survived and prospered where many of her original hippie contemporaries did not. She had the temerity to make money eventually, to figure out or at least accept that the dream could not grow, much less survive, in a commune. If you're still looking to find the true genius behind the whole thing, examining old menus at Chez Panisse pre-Tower and post-Tower, for instance, you may as well be scrutinizing blurry photographs of the grassy knoll. There is, as with the Kennedy assassination, a case to be made for a second shooter. But spend too long looking, and in the end, you miss the point entirely. Alice Waters is still here. Jeremiah Tower is not. Alice is widely known and will probably always be known as the mother of slow food. Jeremiah Tower allowed himself to become a footnote to history. And history, as they say, will always be written by the victors. Chapter 13. Heroes and Villains. Fergus Henderson is a hero. In the best heroic tradition, he'd be mortified to hear this. He's English, for one, and painfully modest about all the adulation. His restaurant, St. John, was intended as an equally modest venture, a plain white room in a former smokehouse where a few like-minded Englishmen could eat traditional English food and drink French claret. I'm quite sure that his aspirations for the book Nose to Tail Eating, also known as The Whole Beast in the United States, a collection of recipes and related musings, were even more limited. Yet Nose to Tail is now considered one of the classic cookbooks of all time, a collector's item, a must-have for any chef anywhere in the world wanting cred from his peers, the Bible for the ever-growing guts mafia, the opening shot in an ongoing, if slow-motion battle that's still, even today, changing the whole world of food. St. John the Restaurant, an undecorated white room serving barely garnished English country fare, continues to be lavishly and at times ludicrously overpraised. Frequently named one of the best restaurants in the world, ahead of temples of haute gastronomy that are technically far more deserving of those kinds of official honors. I believe Fergus has even been honored by the Queen for his service to the crown, which is also crazy if you think about it, for a one-time architect who dropped out and started cooking bistro grub soon after to specialize in the kind of country-ass stuff his grandmother used to cook. But he is a hero. That he's my hero is well documented. Since my first meal at St. John, when I flopped onto my knees in the kitchen, babbling something spectacularly idiotic but heartfelt like, "You rock," Fergus wasn't even there that evening, I've shamelessly basked in his reflected glory at every opportunity. I'm a supporter, an acolyte, a devotee, an advocate for all things Henderson. I am a true believer. I believe that Fergus Henderson, in a way that very few chefs have ever been, is good for society as a whole. Because unlike any chef I've ever heard of, he has influenced people who've never been to St. John, never eaten his food, certainly never read his book, and don't have any idea who the fuck this Fergus Henderson guy might be. He has, however unwittingly, given permission to generations of chefs and cooks to follow their hearts in ways that were unthinkable only a few years ago. Simply by doing what he's doing, he's inspired others to put things on their menus and look at ingredients they might never have thought of had he not done it first. And as the word spreads, minds and menus change, and no one even knows where it all might have started. Mario Batali, Chris Cosentino, Martin Picard, April Bloomfield, Gabrielle Hamilton are obvious examples of chefs who felt liberated by Fergus's early example. I say obvious because they'd be the first to tell you. But it's all the others, the lone chefs and cooks out there in the heartland of America, England, and Australia, who yearned for a Fergus to come along and inspire them, give them courage, long before he actually appeared. I will never forget the smell of the rooms years ago, tiny venues in rural England, in working-class cities where Fergus was on book tour. All the kids came out, still stinking of the deep fryer, the chip shop, whatever crappy pub, depressing and wrong-headed lounge restaurant they might have been working at the time. Many of them had never even been to London, but they knew who Fergus was all right and what he was all about, and the look on their faces of ambition and hope was inspiring. My most treasured Fergus-related memory, and one of the most moving goddamn things I've ever seen, was when he accompanied me to my old alma mater, the CIA. I was concerned. I knew that the 300-seat auditorium would fill with my fans. It had been my school, after all, the home team, and 20-year-old slacker male culinary students, freshly tattooed with cook free or die, are usually not a tough crowd for me. But I was worried about the reception Fergus might get. He was English, with the kind of upper-class speech patterns filled with Britishisms one would expect of an eccentric country squire. He spoke faintly, and with a pronounced stammer. He was sick, very sick. He had not yet had the experimental surgery that would help mitigate the symptoms of his Parkinson's, and his body jerked around at times, robotically sending an arm straight out into space. He was funny-looking in the best of circumstances, often described as owlish behind round glasses. Would any of these young louts know who he was, I wondered. More important, would they listen? Would they pay attention during his talk? Would they give this man the respect he was due? Or would they, after a few minutes, start staring off into space or dribbling off to the exits? I ended my litany of war stories and dick jokes and handed the floor over to Fergus. He began to speak, faintly, worryingly flushed, arm wonky. And every fucking kid in that room leaned forward in their seat and held their breath. For 45 minutes, no one made a sound. They listened, absolutely rapt, to the master. They knew who he was, all right. Fucking A they did. And at the end of the talk, they asked questions. Bright, incisive, enthusiastic ones, too. I stood silently in the rear, trying not to start blubbering like a fucking baby. It was like the end of Pride of the Yankees, and I do start weeping when I see that shit. I'd never seen anything so encouraging in my life. Which is why I'm putting Gail Green on my list of villains. Not because she deserves to be vilified for her writing, which was once very important and is still, more often than not, when she's not talking about boning Elvis, quite good. I probably couldn't be doing what I'm doing if she hadn't done it first. Or for any of the obvious reasons why one would want to make fun of the woman referred to by chefs as Sergeant Pepper for her bizarre look-at-me Peter Frampton Michael Jackson gopher from Love Boat outfits. Hell, in another context, she'd probably be a hero. But no, Gail joins the ranks of the damned because she moderated a panel discussion at the 92nd Street Y in New York City a while back, and she was lucky enough to have Fergus Henderson on her panel, and she barely acknowledged him. She kept getting his name wrong. She blathered on and on about her favorite subject, herself, while ignoring the most influential chef of the last 10 years sitting a few feet away. For abusing this opportunity, for paying insufficient respect to my friend, for treating the great man as any less than the titan he is. For this alone, let her join the ranks of the damned. Jonathan Gold, the food writer for LA Weekly, is a hero. I'm hardly the first to notice. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his dedicated and pioneering coverage of all those places in the LA area that nobody had ever covered before. His award was the first for a food writer. He gave them respect, treating little mom-and-pop noodle shops and strip malls with a degree of importance they hadn't enjoyed before. He helped give a legitimacy to serious critical analyses of Thai, Vietnamese, inexpensive Mexican, and less appreciated regional cuisines which hadn't really existed before. He put them on a par with fine dining and wrote about them with as much, if not more, enthusiasm, helping to usher in a very useful kind of reverse snobism. A skepticism about fine dining that has only been helpful and a good thing in the long run. And the motherfucker can write. Oh, can he write. Good, original sentences on the subject of food are an all-too-rare thing, and Gold pretty much owns his territory. As a writer, as a force for good, as a guy who upped the ante for anyone daring to write about food or simply looking for food to eat, he's a hero. By writing about food, he's helped change how and where people eat it. In a near unbroken field of mediocrity, here is a man who makes just about anything or any place he cares to talk about seem like some place you should care about. Since we're in LA, allow me to take the opportunity to put Wolfgang Puck on the villains list. Puck goes on the list precisely because he's one of the biggest, best and most important chefs of the last few decades. What you think of his airport pizza is completely beside the point. Puck long ago did enough important world-changing work to ensure his status as one of the greats. He was a vital part of the American food revolution. He made serious contributions to changing the whole popular notion of who and what a chef even was. Part of the whole tectonic shift away from the idea of the maitre d' being the star to the new idea that it was the chef who was important. The chefs and cooks who came up with and graduated from Puck's kitchen, so many of them, make for a breathtaking lineup. His is a major tree trunk in the genealogy of American cooking. With God knows how many restaurants and the merch line and everything else going on in Puckland, presumably Wolfgang has plenty of money. He is, inarguably, big. Maybe the big tuna in a town of big fishes. He is a powerful, influential, and deservedly respected chef and one of the most recognizable names in the business. So I was really disappointed, felt betrayed, when he knuckled under to the anti-foie gras people and announced he'd take it off all his menus in all his businesses. When more vulnerable, less well-capitalized, less famous peers were standing up, when some chefs were being threatened, their families terrorized, why did Puck go over to the other side? It seemed that of all the chefs in the country, he was best situated to simply say, fuck you to the forces of darkness, and tough it through. Here, I assumed, was a wealthy, powerful, influential man with, one would imagine, many powerful friends. I figured he looked at the situation and calculated that it would be easier to just give the assholes what they wanted. At the time, I believe I called it treason. But I'm told the story was a little more complicated than that, and the pressures on Puck more severe than a few protesters out front. He was getting it from all sides, from within and without his organization, it is said. His partners and allies squeezed themselves, in turn squeezed Puck. Wolfgang is not the only shareholder of Wolfgang Puck Worldwide Incorporated, and apparently his partners made things very, very hot for him. So maybe victim and villain would be more appropriate. I'm not as pissed off as I was, just really disappointed. Because if not Puck, then who? Jamie Oliver is a hero. Before you spit up your gnocchi, turn back to the cover of this book and make sure you're reading the right author, let me explain. I hated The Naked Chef too, and all that matey mockney bullshit, and the Sainsbury's business, and the band, and the scooter, all that shit that made Jamie a star. But I don't know what I would do if I Googled I hate Anthony Bourdain and saw a million or so hits like Jamie would find if he Googled the same phrase but with his name. I don't know what I would do if I woke up one morning and, like Jamie, found a website dedicated to me named FatTongueCunt.com where hundreds, if not thousands, of people appeared to be spending half their working hours and maybe all their leisure time photoshopping movie posters and twisting titles to refer as disparagingly as possible to me. I'd be afraid to leave the house seeing that kind of ferocity and loathing. I do have a pretty good idea what I'd do, however, if I had the kind of big money Jamie's got, and it would not be the same as what he's doing with it. Say what you will about how well, how attractively, or how advisably, but Jamie Oliver puts his money where his mouth is. The sincerity with which he's focused on school lunches, educating kids on how to cook, and even how to eat, is largely, I gather, unwelcomed, and relative to potentially more purely profit-oriented exercises, maybe not the best of options. Jamie would clearly prefer to be an annoying nag, reminding us that we're fat and unhealthy, than make more money. You have to admire that. Sure, he's still bringing down plenty of dough, but you gotta respect a guy who manages to embarrass the whole British government with a show about what their school kids are actually eating. That kind of talk will eventually make you unpopular. It's very rarely a good career move to have a conscience. If experience teaches us anything, it's that the very last thing a television audience wants to hear or be reminded of is how bad things are, how unhealthy or how doomed, that we're heading off a cliff and dragging our kids after us, unless it's accompanied by bombastic accusations of conspiracy and a suitable candidate to blame for the problem. It's bad business to be saying all sorts of awful, alarmist shit like that, particularly when it's true. It is much better business, always, to tell people over and over again in a reassuring voice, or better yet, a loud, annoying one, that everything is just fine. It'll all work out. The kids can keep jamming soda and chips into their neckless maws. They'll be okay. No need to worry. You're great. You're awesome. And here's a recipe for deep-fried potato pizza. Jamie Oliver is a hero for doing the harder thing, when he surely doesn't have to do anything at all. Most chefs I know, were they where Jamie is on the successometer, they'd be holed up at a Four Seasons somewhere, shades drawn, watching four tranny hookers snort cocaine off each other. Brooke Johnson, the head honcho at Food Network, is a villain. That's an easy one. But she's a villain for being right. Not for the cynical, fake-ass, soul-destroying, lowest common denominator shit shows she's nurtured and supported since taking the helm. She's a villain for being clearly and demonstrably right about everything. On her watch, the network's audience share has exploded. The number of male viewers most treasured by advertisers expands exponentially every year. Demographics of viewers watching Food Network tilting to the good in ways that are the envy of every other network. That prime quality cut of big spending, ever younger male viewers getting larger and larger with each financial quarter. Every clunky, bogus, critically vilified clusterfuck that drops from FN's hindquarters still steaming and seemingly dead on arrival turns out to be an unprecedented rating success. Even the FN-branded magazines are doing monster business. Nearly alone in an otherwise bleak field littered with the dead, they have thrived, becoming plump and then plumper with ad pages. There's an unimpeachable logic to your argument when no matter what one may say about what you do, or even how true their observations might be, you can respond with two words. It works. Whatever Brooke Johnson has done, it is working. That success ensures that whoever complains about quality sounds quaint, even deranged, like some sad old Hollywood shrunken head talking about Ford and Lubitsch, Selznick and Thalberg to an interviewer who has no idea who or what they're talking about. And for that, and the fact that she couldn't and probably shouldn't give a shit whether she's a villain or not, she's a villain. Wiley Dufresne is a hero, because he's made a life's work of doing exactly the opposite of what Brooke Johnson does. At his restaurant, WD-50, where you're likely to actually find him most nights, He doesn't care if you don't understand the food. He will not be moved from his plan if people hate an occasional dish. It doesn't matter to Wiley if, on balance, most of you would rather have a steak, that he would surely struggle less and make a lot more money, please more of the dining public, if only he made some compromises. He knows that even if you love everything on his menu, his is not the kind of meal that people come back for every week. Wiley Dufresne is a fucking hero because he's got amazing skills, a restless mind, and balls the size of pontoons. He's decided to do the hard thing, whatever the cost, rather than following the much easier path that has always been readily available to a chef of his considerable advantages. He could have been anybody he wanted, had whatever kind of restaurant, whatever kind of career, and he chose this. To his constant peril, he experiments, pushes boundaries, explores what is possible, what might be possible. In doing so, he develops techniques and ideas that, after he's done all the work and taken the time and risk, are promptly ripped off by chefs all over the world, usually without any acknowledgement. For exactly the same reasons, Grant Achatz is a hero. Only more so, because he not only put what is perhaps the most impressive resume a chef could have at the service of innovation, experimentation, and the investigation of those things about which he is curious, but he also risked his life in order to continue doing so. When you're talking about commitment to one's craft, about rigorously and inflexibly sticking with one's goals and the highest possible standards, there's really no one who's demonstrated that so consistently or been willing to sacrifice so much. Alain Ducasse, on the other hand, is a villain, because he almost single-handedly brought down fine dining in America with his absurdly pretentious restaurant, Alain Ducasse New York, or ADNY as it was known. While total destruction might narrowly have been avoided, public perception, even among friendlies, of the kind of European-style Michelin star place that he aspired to took a serious hit, causing the beginnings of a slow bleed that continues to this day. Walking into ADNY, I loved the idea of haute cuisine unconditionally. I left a heretic, the seeds of doubt planted in my heart like the first toxic pangs of jealousy in a lover. And it wasn't just me. ADNY damaged in many minds the whole idea of luxurious dining rooms and service, made those things dangerously uncool, features you almost have to explain or apologize for these days, something to be overcome by the food. To use an egregiously overused expression, ADNY was where fine dining jumped the shark. Ducasse revved up the engine of his bike, released his hand from the brake, and took the whole concept hurtling heedlessly across the shark tank, where, unlike in Fonzie's case, it was doubtful in the extreme that Pinky Tuscadero would be waiting for him. When he rolled into New York with his bad attitude, ungracious proclamations of how exclusive his new place would be, how unwelcome New Yorkers might be if they were not already acquainted with himself via Monaco or Paris, Ducasse did nothing so much as drop a gigantic Cleveland steamer into a small pond previously occupied by his much smarter and savvier compatriots. You can bet they saw it for what it was. Previously, you'd never heard members of the old French Guard talking shit about one of their own, not publicly anyway, but this was different. This guy was fucking it up for everybody. The little tuffets for ladies' bags, the selection of steak knives to choose from, the waiters who put on white gloves to trim fresh herbs tableside, the fucking water cart, the even more painful array of Mont Blanc pens to choose from so that one might more elegantly sign one's check, the dark, hideous, and pretentious dining room, all of it conspired to smother any possibility of a good time stone dead in a long, dreary dirge. Nothing could live in this temple of hubris. The generally excellent food was no match for the forces aligned against it. And it just wasn't, in the end, excellent enough to prevail against the ludicrousness of what surrounded it. Like watching Bonfire of the Vanities or Heaven's Gate or one of the other great examples of ego gone wild in the movie business, there were so many miscalculations, large and small, that the whole wrong-headed mess added up to something that wasn't just bad, but insulting. You left ADNY angry and offended that anyone, much less this out-of-touch French guy, would think you were so stupid. New Yorkers don't like to be treated like rubes. tends to leave a bad taste. And the bad taste one left with after ADNY metastasized into something larger. Feelings of doubt about the desirability and even the morality of that kind of luxury. Few in the hermetic world of Francophile New York foodies had ever really asked those questions before. Now they were asking. There's been no sign since, by the way, that Ducasse has gotten much smarter. Other than having the wisdom to close ADNY, after initial reviews of a new brasserie concept were negative, he suggested publicly that New Yorkers were unfamiliar with this kind of food, and that it was up to the critics to educate them to the complexities of exotica like Blanquette de Veau and Choucroute. Which came as news, I'm sure, to the many, many distinguished French chefs who've been doing exactly that to great acclaim for decades. For being an arrogant fuckwit who nearly ruined it for all of us, Alain Ducasse is a villain. Terence Brennan is a hero, because back in the Stone Age, he was the only guy around who loved cheese enough to lose money on it. For years, Brennan, the chef owner of Picholine and Artisanal in New York City, was the first American chef to get really serious about the French-style cheese course. It's not like anybody was asking. It wasn't like there'd been a popular outcry for soft, runny, prohibitively expensive cheeses with which few Americans were familiar and even fewer inclined to ever like. Even today, mention stinky cheese and relatively few are they who will respond positively. Sure, heroic cheesemongers like Robert Kaufelt at Murray's Cheese Shop have been making a good living selling an impressive variety of the world's great cheeses for ages. But making a go of cheese in a restaurant situation was a very different matter. Back in the day, the cheese board was, at restaurants of a certain type, an obligatory exercise at best. At the kind of fine dining frog ponds where the waiters spoke with French or Italian accents, and the crystal and linens were of good quality, the flowers freshly cut, the menu French or continental, cheese was something you offered because that was the sort of thing your customers expected. They'd been to Europe many times. They knew that after the main courses, cheese is offered. Nobody actually ordered the shit, and had they tried, they would often find a perfunctory display of usual suspects. Unripe or too ripe brie. Maybe a camembert, usually in even worse shape. A sad disc of undistinguished Chèvre, something hard and vaguely Swiss. And a lonely and unloved wedge of something blue. Probably the same Roquefort used elsewhere on the menu. In fact, the key to offering a cheese course and getting away with it was to make sure that everything on the cheese board was used elsewhere on the menu. Cheese is expensive, very expensive, and perishable, and delicate. Properly aged, stored, served, and handled cheese is even more expensive. Every time you cut into an intact cheese, its time on this earth becomes limited. Every time you pull one out of the special refrigerated cave it lives in, you are killing it slowly. Every time you return it partially served back to the refrigerator, you are also killing it. Whichever employee is serving your cheese, every uneven cut, every pilfered slice or smear can pretty much end any possibility of a return on your investment. In fact, to properly serve a reasonably excellent selection of cheeses, always at their peak ripenesses and at proper temperatures, one almost must accept the imperative of throwing a lot of it out sooner or later, or find a way to use it elsewhere. And the more varieties of cheese you offer, the less likely you will be able to merchandise all of the remnants as ingenious appetizers. It is very rare, even in the best of circumstances, that a customer will order a separate cheese course prior to and distinct from dessert. The arrival of cheeses on a cart tableside presents a potentially awkward situation for a large party. Should we wait for the asshole here who insisted on ordering a few reeking blues and some port, or should we just go ahead and order desserts? So, cheese is not exactly a loss leader, meaning an expensive or cumbersome item that does not in itself make money, but which somehow inspires others to order things that will make money. If people do decide to have cheese as a dessert course, there's no way you're making more money on a nicely aged Stilton than you would be had everybody simply ordered creme brulee or ice cream, which costs much less to produce. You have to be a romantic to invest yourself, your money, and your time in cheese. And that's a very dangerous thing to be in the restaurant business. One of the great suicidal expressions has always been educate the customer. You hear that kind of talk from your business partner? It's usually way too late to roll your eyes at the ceiling and plead for sanity. But Terence Brennan actually did, and continues to educate his customers, and somehow to get away with it, even succeed and expand. After introducing the cheese concept to Picholine, he built a whole additional business around it at Artisanal. So far in front of everybody else, he's still out front, years later. He not only heroically defied the conventional wisdom of the times, he helped change the conventional wisdom. Where there was no market at all, he created one. The dining public may not have known that it needed a selection of over 100 cheeses. They certainly didn't know they needed to know about small production American cheeses from previously unknown cheesemakers in Maine, Oregon, and even New Jersey. Brennan, by taking a chance on cheese, helped create not just a market to sell cheese, but an emerging sector dedicated to making cheese. Finally, for all those lonely would-be cheesemakers pondering the possibilities of great homegrown American cheese, there was a chef, restaurateur out there who might buy them, promote them, dedicate himself and his business to hand-selling them to the public. Terence Brennan is a hero. By taking a series of mad risks, he's raised all boats, made things better for all of us. Jim Harrison is a hero, because there's nobody, nobody left like him. The last of the true gourmands, the last connection to the kind of writing about food that A.J. Liebling used to do. Passionate, knowledgeable, but utterly without snobbery, as likely to gush over an ugly but delicious tripe a la mode or order of roasted kidneys as a once-in-a-lifetime meal at a triple-starred Michelin. Harrison, author of many fine books and even more fine poems, has done everything cool with everybody who's ever been cool, dating back to when they invented the fucking word. He knows how to cook, he has impeccable taste in wine, he knows how to eat. At his own book party in New York City a while back, Harrison, whom I'd met previously only once, spent the entire evening standing outside with me, whom he hardly knew, chain-smoking and talking about food, ignoring the rich, the powerful, the famous, and the smart, who waited for him inside. At the grizzled age of 72, suffering variously from gout and many other complaints, he's a rock star in France, barely able to walk down the street without being mobbed, and he lives like one. The French understand the greatness of such men immediately. The lazy and the foolish compare him to Hemingway, which is a terrible injustice, as Jim is both a better writer and a better man. I don't know many people who could be called great, but Jim would be one of them. He smokes, he drinks, and regularly attempts frottage with an impunity and a style that will disappear after him. Speaking of old fuckers, the James Beard House goes on the villain list because it harbors and gives safe haven to villains. It gives them somewhere to go. It provides comfort and succor and the illusion of importance to a bunch of supremely irrelevant old fucks who have nothing to do and nothing to say of any significance to the restaurant business they claim to support and love. It's a private dining society for the soon-to-be incontinent, like the Friars Club for old mummies who never themselves told a joke but like to hang around comedians. When the president of the Beard Foundation got pinched for embezzlement a while back, it should have come as a surprise to no one. For years, even the casual observer could watch as money goes in, nothing comes out. But nobody gave a shit. After the news went public that this nobody, this nebbish from nowhere, had been feathering his nest, everybody was shocked, shocked, and rushed to separate themselves from the wreckage with unseemly speed and appropriate expressions of outrage. But that was the purpose of the whole enterprise, to give jobs and power to the otherwise powerless and unemployable. I'll never forget my friend Chef Matt Moran's experience. Matt is a big cheese in Sydney, his restaurant Aria one of the best in the country. Invited to cook a meal at the Beard House, he packed the best of his kitchen staff, all his ingredients in his bags, and flew them all, at great expense, to New York. Having heard of the notoriously impossible-to-work-in kitchen at the house, why would an institution honoring the work of chefs actually have a kitchen they could cook in? He managed to arm-twist every chef friend he had in New York to make use of their busy restaurants' kitchens to prepare. I agreed to help finish and serve the meal. We managed to crank out the meal, A very ambitious, very modern menu featuring the best of Australian seafood, meat, cheese, and wines. And afterward, when the chef was summoned to the dining room to take a bow, receive much-deserved kudos, and answer a few questions, I watched. He walked into the room expecting the cream, or at least some, of New York's food media. There was none. There rarely is. He would surely have settled, I'm guessing, for what could optimistically be called a compliment of the town's influential diners or foodie elite. No, not at all. One look at the clueless duffers blinking up at him uncomprehendingly from their tables, and it was clear he'd been snookered. How much had he spent on this exercise in futility? To fly all that food, all those cooks, all those miles from the other side of the world, put them up in hotels, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, all that work? And here comes the first question from the floor. Yes, the gentleman over there who looks like he just limped away from the shrimp buffet at a suburban golf club. The man fixes Moran in his blurry gaze, leans back in his chair, pats his belly for effect, and asks, "So, chef, you're from Australia, right? How come we didn't have any kangaroo or like koala on the menu?" Somewhere inside Moran, I saw something die. He knew now. He had the information. Beard House. Evil. Ariane Dagin is a hero. 25 or 26 years ago, Ariane, who'd been working for a purveyor manufacturer of French-style charcuterie, started up a small business dedicated to producing and providing to local chefs New York State foie gras, as well as other products and preparations that French chefs of the time wanted, needed, and had not previously been able to get. She started out with one truck and a dream. A quarter century later, her business, D'Artagnan, has become very successful, but at great personal and financial cost. She's had to wage a constant and very expensive war, both legal and for the hearts and minds of the public, to protect her right to sell this traditional product. Yet she has gone way, way beyond protecting her own interests and her own business. Almost alone, she has been there for chefs and purveyors across the country who have run afoul of the at times dangerous anti-foie activists. She was a prime mover in the counterattack after foie gras was banned in Chicago. She is there to offer support when individual chefs are terrorized or their businesses targeted for vandalism or disruption. She has put her money at the service of people who will never buy her products or know her name. Nearly alone, she defends a culinary tradition dating back to Roman times. The right to hand-feed ducks and geese who live in far better conditions than any chicken ever sold at the Colonel's until their livers become plump and delicious. She has shown far, far more courage on this issue than any chef I know. Mario Batali and Eric Ripert and Jose Andres are heroes, because they raise more money for charity and put in more time doing it than movie stars and CEOs 50 times wealthier than they are. Jose Andres is also a hero because, I strongly suspect, he's secretly an agent for some ultra-classified and very cool department of the Spanish Foreign Ministry. He's the unofficial food ambassador for Spain, Spanish products, and Spanish chefs. You can't talk to the motherfucker for 5 minutes without him gently slipping mention of Spanish ham or Spanish cheese or Spanish olive oil into the conversation. When Jose's lips move, you never know who's actually talking. Ferran Adrià? Juan Marie Arzac? Anthony Aduriz? Or the nation itself? Somebody is sending you a message. You can just never be sure who. At the end of the day, all you can be sure of is that the message will be delicious. Regina Schrambling is both hero and villain. My favorite villain, actually. The former New York Times and LA Times food writer and blogger is easily the angriest person writing about food. Her weekly blog entries at gastropoda.com are a deeply felt, episodic unburdening, a venting of all her bitterness, rage, contempt, and disappointment with a world that never seems to live up to her expectations. She hates nearly everything and everybody, and when she doesn't, she hates herself for allowing such a thing to happen. She never lets an old injury, a long-ago slight, go. She proofreads her former employer, the New York Times, with an eye for detail, every typo, any evidence of further diminution of quality, and when she can latch on to something, as let's face it, she always can, she unleashes a withering torrent of ridicule and contempt. She hates Alice Waters. She hates George Bush. She'll still be writing about him with the same blind rage long after he's dead of old age. She hates Ruth Reichel, Mario Batali, Frank Bruni, Mark Bittman, me. She hates the whole rotten, corrupt, self-interested sea in which she must swim, a daily ordeal which at the same time she feels compelled to chronicle. She hates hypocrisy, silliness, mendacity. She is immaculate in the consistency and regularity of her loathing. She is also very funny and frequently right about things. And always, even when I strongly disagree with her, worth reading. She rarely, if ever, commits the first and most common sin of food writing, being boring. For inventing cute names for her targets, though, and not having the stones to simply say what everybody knows she is saying, she's a villain. If you're going to piss on Mario every other week, say Mario Batali, not Molto Ego. Stand up fucking proud and tell us why you hate Mario Batali and everything he touches. Which also makes her a villain in my book, because it's all fine and good to loathe Mario in person and in principle, but to deny any value at all in any of his enterprises is criminally disingenuous, particularly for a food writer. His name is Frank Bruni, not the funny name Panchito she refers to him by. And for the unpardonable act of being insufficiently critical of George W. Bush in the run-up to the election, a transgression Bruni was hardly alone in committing, his every word, as the eventual Times dining critic was, from his shrambling anyway, utterly worthless or worse. I think Alan Richman is a douchebag. Writing the chapter about him in this book felt really good. Regina should try to be as specific as possible and clearly identify the targets of her derision. Hero, villain, with Regina shrambling, it doesn't matter. She is, even at her crankiest, most unfair, and most vindictive, good for the world of food and dining. A useful emetic, a periodic scourging, the person shouting fire repeatedly in a too-crowded room. You have to respect the depth and duration of her scorn. I do. She is, unfortunately, a return to that vanishing breed of food writer and gourmet who claims to love food, yet secretly loathes the people who actually cook it. While this might, if you think about it, be an indicator of good instincts on her part, it is unlovely, to be sure. But somebody has to call bullshit regularly on those of us who cook or write about food or talk about it, even when wrong. There needs to be someone out there constantly watching. It may as well be Regina. I can't wait to read her next blog entry.